whole public has always viewed the criminal justice system through the optics of guilt. And by developing all these wrongful conviction cases and then people asking the question, what went wrong, for the first time as a nation we're starting to view the criminal justice system through the optics of innocence.
One of the reasons that things have gone so wrong is that people are mistakenly identified. You've made that point many times.
Yeah. I mean, we've had now about, just in DNA exonerations alone, of course, there have been many other people exonerated without the benefit of DNA. But of the DNA cases, we've now had 306, and about 75% of those cases involve misidentifications.
And why is that so common? Why is it so easy to look at a lineup and pick the wrong guy?
Probably one of the biggest reasons, okay, has to do with suggestive behavior on the part of the police. So, for instance, you have to recall that in a lineup or a photo spread, there's only one suspect and the other five or six people are fillers selected by the police. So they know before the identification procedure is run that that they have a suspect. And they may, even unwittingly, not intentionally, but unwittingly, communicate certain hints or suggestions to a witness to pick, you know, look at number three. Look at number three, Mrs. Smith. Doesn't he look unusual or something like that? And you'll see things like that happen. It could be body language. And so one of the key reforms is to have a person run the ID procedure who's not involved with the case, who doesn't know which one is the suspect and which ones are the fillers, to prevent that even inadvertent suggestion.
You said police are not necessarily wittingly doing this, but if they even unwittingly and then it's later found that they were wrong, that they had the wrong suspect, it's still difficult to admit that.
It's very difficult. I mean, one of the things we do when we have a wrongful conviction is, of course, we go back to the prosecutors and the police and show how the DNA is dispositive of the question of guilt. And very often, folks are extremely resistant. They're resistant for a couple of reasons. One, they've expended a great deal of emotional energy and time believing that this man committed the crime. It could be 10 years, 20 years, whatever. And it's very hard to give that up psychologically. Secondly, you know, you got to remember that these are not isolated events. And if somebody engaged in conduct which generated a wrongful conviction in one situation, they may very well have done it in others. And so when you lift up that stone and you see what's underneath it, God knows what you're going to see. So a lot of people in law enforcement and prosecutors are resistant to lifting that stone.
Do you think the public now has the mistaken notion that because DNA is such a great tool that it's going to solve all this problem of misidentification, when in fact DNA evidence is not something that's necessarily even going to be present?
Yeah, there's no question that all those TV shows give the audience the impression that that DNA or other kind of whiz-bang toys will solve crimes, things that haven't even been invented yet. The truth is that, according to the crime lab directors, they estimate that biological evidence suitable for DNA testing is present in no more than 10 to 15% of all violent crime. And so police will have to use other more old-fashioned methods to solve crime, like lineups, like interrogations. Sometimes they rely on jailhouse informants, all those kinds of things. And what we're trying to do is to enhance the reliability when we can of those methods. And if it turns out that the methods are completely invalid and the people are completely unscrupulous, then they should be deposited in a trash can.
I'm sure you've been following the Amanda Knox case. It's gotten a lot of headlines in recent years, especially because she's now speaking out about it. Is that in some ways a textbook case of how someone can get caught up in a system that maybe she's guilty, maybe she's not?
Yeah, I don't know a lot about the details of the case, so I can't opine on innocence or guilt. But what I can say is that when she describes what happened during the interrogation, that is a textbook case on how you can easily produce a false confession. Some people actually said that that they were surprised that when she denied it, that she implicated somebody else initially, and they said they're not familiar with that phenomena. Well, we've seen dozens of cases where individuals, as part of the interrogation, the police try and minimize your conduct and say, we're sure you did very little. Why don't you just tell us what he did or what she did or what someone else did? And so people are led down that path. That's actually the method utilized by police all over the world when they conduct interrogations. As a result of that, if you look at the Central Park Five, where they were each, you know, told to mitigate their own, minimize their own involvement, but yet implicate other kids who were all innocent. That's happened in two Chicago cases recently that I was involved in. It happened in a case we did in Texas. It happens all the time, in other words. So the fact that she did that is of no great surprise to us. That happens all the time in false confession cases. But you can just imagine what it's like where you're in a strange country and you're having some difficulty with the language, and all of a sudden you're, you know, you're just overwhelmed by the situation. And the police are doing everything they can to break down your defenses, render you extremely vulnerable. And all you want is for this thing to end. And if by ending it, you can simply say what they want to hear, then so be it. And we've had dozens of clients do that. Because, you know, in a third of our cases, our clients made false confessions.
Certainly one of the effects of your work with the Innocence Project and others is that there is a rising tide of movement in this country to abolish the death penalty. And it's because people are convinced now that the system, justice system, is so flawed that innocent people for sure can be on death row.
Well, we had our 300th exoneration a few months ago, and he was a gentleman who was on death row in Angola prison down in Louisiana. We've now, of the 300 or so, 18 of them were on death row, and they would have been executed but for the serendipitous intervention of DNA testing. You know, I think there's no question that DNA has changed the debate. People are less getting bogged down in political differences, philosophical or religious differences, and they're saying to themselves, my God, the system is simply too vulnerable, too prone to error, to allow us to exact an irreversible punishment. We had a case yesterday in Mississippi where the Mississippi Supreme Court just 3 weeks ago in a 5-4 decision turned down an inmate's request for DNA testing and said he should be executed. And the FBI and the Justice Department submitted unprecedented letters to the court just 3 or 4 days ago acknowledging that their own agents, when they testified at the murder trial in Mississippi 20 years ago, provided scientifically invalid testimony that they shouldn't have provided. And as a result of those letters from the FBI, yesterday, the Mississippi Supreme Court, in an 8-1 decision, stayed that execution just 3 hours before he was to lose his life. So things are changing. Even the FBI is stepping forward. They want to deal with mistakes of the past. They want to correct them, and they want to do what they can to make sure that people are not executed as a result of them.
Obviously, the justice system is always evolving, like every institution in this country. But part of that, certainly evolution in a positive way, is due to the work of Peter Neufeld, civil rights attorney I've been speaking with and co-founder of the Innocence Project, which, as you say, has exonerated over 300 people now. Mr. Neufeld, thank you so much.
Thank you.